Support for the following program comes from the National Endowment for the Humanities. Additional funding comes from the A.J. Fletcher Foundation and from Carolina Power and Light, where listening generates powerful ideas.
This is Soundings, a program of ideas and insights from the National Humanities Center. I'm Wayne Pond. The Dead Sea Scrolls, the Ethics of Scholarship and Modern Religious History, this week on Soundings. Join me now for conversations with scholars from Duke, Indiana, and Rutgers universities. When the Dead Sea Scrolls were unearthed in 1947, they were acclaimed as the greatest of modern manuscript discoveries. In addition to the oldest known copies of the canonical books, sacred to both Jews and Christians, the scrolls also provided insights into secular life in biblical times. But until last fall, when a research library in California released photographs of the scrolls, their availability to scholars was tightly controlled. Eric Myers is a longtime student of scripture and ancient cultures. He teaches at Duke University, has served as president of the American Schools of Oriental Research, and currently directs the Annenberg Research Institute. I asked Eric Myers to comment on the ethics of modern biblical scholarship and to discuss the meaning of the Dead Sea Scrolls today.
Well, in this regard, the Dead Sea Scrolls have provided tremendous testimony as to the great variety within late Second Temple Judaism and even within the framework of early Palestinian Christianity as we know it in the first century.
Not monolithic, in other words. Not Cecil B. DeMille back there grinding out a sort of grand technicolor narrative.
Not at all. We now know Judaism to be in the last centuries before the Common Era to be greatly variegated, diverse, with all sorts of peoples challenging one another for position, political machinations, and all sorts of writing going on. And that kind of is very helpful a counterpoint to the old from the 50s and 60s and early part of the 20th century, for that matter, which assumed that Judaism was moving towards some central formation, which ultimately won out. And people would call this normative Judaism. There was no normative Judaism in the Second Temple period. Christianity, it would seem, not only from the perspective of what we knew before the Dead Sea Scrolls, but especially now in light of them, seems to be part of this richness. Early Christianity is part and parcel of the richness that was late Second Temple Judaism.
All right. Now, you can use a word like, let me be politely disrespectful, Eric. You can sit here and use a word like richness. That also translates to a word like complexity. That translates to a word like, don't bug me, don't mess with my stereotypical notions of the early Christian church. Leave me alone in my beliefs. Is that too strong to say that the Dead Sea Scrolls, if we really knew about them and if we circulated publicly what's available to scholars, that it would shatter these illusions, these stereotypical notions?
Well, I think that's in part correct. People don't like to think that there were Jews in this period who were monastics or early kibbutzniks who... They don't like to think of their forebears in quite the light that the Dead Sea Scrolls presents them. Mm-hmm. I think, on the other hand, the Catholic Church is certainly very happy with the depiction of the Dead Sea Scrolls being monastic, eschewing marriage. It sort of gives a kind of legitimacy to that lifestyle that was hitherto unknown in the biblical world. And insofar as several of the original team of scholars were Roman Catholics, I think it gave even a greater mobility and force to this paradigm that is the Dead Sea Scroll community. So we have Essenes, we have Sadducees, we have Pharisees, we have early Christians, mm-hmm. or the followers of Jesus, however you want to describe that. Not of these five major movements was to emerge what we call early Judaism, and Palestinian Christianity.
Was the teacher of righteousness Jesus Christ?
I don't believe so. I know that the press has picked up on this. I believe that the righteous teacher was the founder of the Qumran community, probably would have lived around 200 B.C.
Now, this is the one who is mentioned, the so-called teacher of righteousness is mentioned in the Dead Sea Scrolls, and the leader, we think, of the Essenes.
That's correct. And this would have been hundreds of years before Jesus lived, and we certainly know from historical sources that Jesus lived in the first 3.5 decades of the Common Era.
Do the Dead Sea Scrolls affirm the existence of Christ, of Jesus Christ, to the man that Christians call the Savior of the world?
To our amazement, the Dead Sea Scrolls make no mention whatsoever of the early Christian movement.
So is this comfort to Jewish theology and discomfort to Christian theology? Well, what do historians make of it?
Well, I think it reinforces the image that Christianity was part and parcel of the diversity and richness and fullness that was first century Judaism in all its wonderful, wonderful variety.
Here we are back to that complexity again.
Yes, yes. But all of this hullabaloo really arose because of the fact that the group that was given charge of publishing these documents.
It's a small coterie of men, I take it, mainly men.
These were all men. There were very few women in scholarship back in those days. They were all very distinguished biblical scholars. And the politics of that region greatly intruded into the assignment of the tasks.
For example, Jordan, the country of Jordan, had possession of the scrolls in those days. And one of the conditions was that we, the Jordanian government, will let you look at these things, but nobody of the Jewish faith could participate. Is that
right? That's correct. And it's also more complicated than that because you know history. 1947, there was no Hashemite kingdom. There was no state of Israel. That's when the bulk of Cave 4 discoveries were made. Uh-huh. And so 1948, when Israel was founded and the Hashemite kingdom was founded, you had the whole group of scrolls divided up over international boundaries and borders, and some of them even came to the United States. And it was the American school in Jerusalem, today the Albright Institute, that first was credited with their publication and with their decipherment. And that's an interesting story, too.
Now, why did it take so long for, relatively speaking, so much of the Dead Sea Scroll material to come to public attention? If we didn't have a conspiracy, if we didn't have a cabal of scholars holding this, you know, to their scholarly bosoms, what went wrong that this stuff just didn't get out any sooner?
Well, those of you who have followed in the press the statistical statements pertaining to what has been or what has not been published see two contradictory bits of evidence. The Israel Antiquities Authority says 80% of the Dead Sea Scrolls material has been published.
So what's the big fight about that?
The other side, attacking them, says only 20% has been published.
Mm-hmm.
What Israel means when they say 80% is that of the major scrolls, 80% has been published. What the other side takes into account is Cave 4. Now, Cave 4 includes perhaps 100, 200,000 fragments. Now, the bulk of those has not been published. There's no doubt about that. So they say 80% has not been published. And that is the most difficult thing for the layperson to understand, that these tiny bits and pieces of fragments have to be pieced together, and it can take literally decades and years to put the jigsaw back together.
All right, now one of the words that you have used, Eric Myers, is major or important. Who makes those decisions? Who figures out what is really worthwhile, worthy of scholarly attention and public attention?
Unfortunately, the government of Jordan was not up to the task. They assigned the task to a group of 8 scholars. Now, this was interdenominational Christian. They were priests, ministers, and one layperson, as I've indicated. When Israel took this material over through nationalization of the Rockefeller Museum in 1967 after the Six-Day War, the Antiquities Department got into this. Now, these are bureaucrats. The head of the Antiquities Authority at that time was a retired diplomat. The head of the Antiquities Authority today is a retired general.
Yeah, but isn't it true that among the membership of the Antiquities Authority, you have a distinguished biblical scholar, somebody like Shemediahu Talmon?
This advisory committee on the Dead Sea Scrolls is not yet 2.5 years old.
What difference does that make?
Well, Israel finally got smart and assigned 5 distinguished scholars, biblicists, to tell them what was important.
Rather than bureaucrats.
Exactly.
All right.
Exactly. Enough. And so about 1989, an advisory committee of 5 was established to help the bureaucratic Antiquities Authority decide what was important and how the assignments were going.
So this is good news. Not only, this is good news for scholarship, period.
Right. And what the advisory committee told the Antiquities Authority was this. In order to get its act together, they would have to publish a schedule of publication. They would have to tell the scholars how long it would take, they would have to get this material out. And basically they told them 1997 was the last they'd have to get it out, and they made 50 new assignments. This they did in 1989. And then, of course, came the great bombshell of September 1991, when the Huntington announced they're going to give this stuff to everyone. And then another bombshell in mid-October 1991, the Israel Antiquities Authority followed the Huntington line, and indeed, October 25th announced to the world that they were going to let anybody who wanted to see any of the material on the condition that they wouldn't publish it.
What does all of this have to do with the notion of access to the arcane, the difficult, the question of interpretation? Accusations have flown back and forth that, I don't know how to put it, scholars who are unworthy, who are inaccurate, who are half-baked in their theories and in their scholarship will now have access to this material. Isn't that what scholarship is all about, that you throw it up for grabs and let people say what they want and the truth will win out?
I fully agree that public access to material remains of a written kind is absolutely essential part of the scholarly enterprise. However, in archaeology, from time immemorial, there has been the tradition that the excavator, or the host country which houses an excavation,
owns it,
yeah, and can assign the publication rights to the excavator or anyone else it so chooses.
Well, now that sounds noble, but it also opens the door for possessiveness and a lot of difficulties in getting the truth of an immensely important subject like the Dead Sea Scrolls to the scholarly community and as well as the wider public.
You're absolutely correct. And politics, as I've said, has intervened. Had the 1948 war not occurred, had there been peace and not war, things would have come out lots differently. But it didn't happen that way. And peace is still rather elusive in the Middle East to this day. So it's all the more important to have standards and protocols in place ready for the next great discoveries. And there will be more discoveries of that, I have no doubt.
Eric Myers, I want to thank you for stopping by the National Humanities Center. You're a professor at Duke University and the director of the Annenberg Institute. I appreciate your time here on the radio.
Nice to be with you.
This is Soundings, a program of ideas and insights from the National Humanities Center. I'm Wayne Pond. When historians keep track of organized religion, how do they separate fact from interpretation? How also do they determine the scope and the legitimacy of their investigations? Questions like that were central to a conference that convened last fall at the National Humanities Center. According to 2 of the participants, the writing of modern religious denominational history until recently meant thinking mainly about Protestants. As a result, denominational historians paid little attention to groups such as Roman Catholics, Jews, and the Pentecostal movement. Jan Shipps teaches at Indiana University, Henry Bowden at Rutgers University. I asked Henry Bowden to explain how the writing of modern denominational religious history is changing.
Probably these days it's more an academic lingo. It is an arbitrary, useful device. I think it was used in history, first by John Wesley, who was talking about it in an ecumenical way. Anybody who had the same convictions he did, whatever their denomination, would share the same spirit and program that he did. These days, and for most of its usage, it has come to be a label for the many plural expressions of Protestant religion in the American experience.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
We are standing at the end of a long tradition of denominational studies that were triumphalist, self-congratulatory, defensive, with the implications that others didn't belong or they weren't as good as we were.
So if Wesley begins with the notion of being inclusive, all of a sudden we've come, not all of a sudden, but we have come full circle
over
right now.
We hope so. And when I say that denominations might continue to be used, I have as many hopes as Jan does that new meanings will be pumped into it. Because in this conference, we've looked at not only Methodists and Presbyterians and Baptists, but Mormons, Roman Catholics, Jews, women in the place of all of these, the common people rather than just the prelates and the ministers. Mm-hmm. We're really trying to revolutionize this from the inside out.
Fair enough, Jan.
And also, this is coming at a time when the American culture has stopped talking about being pluralistic as a kind of ideal, so that we tolerate and we are all, we welcome anybody. But America is facing the reality of pluralism, so that there are so many new and different ways of being American, being religious in America.
You after a fashion, Jan Shipps, Henry Bowden, you're talking about this multiculturalism debate. There are a lot of layers going on here. Who's in power, who's out of power, who is marginalized, who's centralized. The historian's craft, as I understand it, has undergone a lot of changes over the past, you can pick a number, two dozen years. From doing the history of people with power.
Yes.
Big shot politicians, you just mentioned the cardinals and the bishops and all of that. By contrast, you are looking as well at people who don't have power and who nevertheless consider themselves to be religious, legitimately.
The people in the pews as well as the people in power is one of the concerns of scholars who are dealing with the religious experience of America.
All right, well, now let me challenge you a little bit on that. It sounds to me like you could be doing history and not religious history.
I don't see much difference at all.
We're going to collapse these things.
Right, and the only thing distinctive about what our approach is, not its approach, but the topics we happen to identify, the kinds of questions that other historians would ask alongside us. And so we are distinctive only in the topic rather than the analysis, the description, and
the judgment.
All right, and here comes the qualifier.
The qualifier is if we do what the keynote speaker, William Hutchinson from Harvard, has asked us to do, is if we look at a religious community, if we treat that community as a case study, we can either treat that community as a case study looking at how religions fit into overall themes in American history, how religion fit into the abolitionist movement,
big-time political things.
That's right. Mm-hmm. Uh-huh. But you can also use groups and the experience of groups to figure out how religion works. Mm-hmm. You can use a case study in either way. You can either go toward figuring out how religion fits into the larger culture, or what looking very closely at a religious group can tell you about how religion works generally.
Henry, why can't we just simply look at the theology, at the internal ground rules of a group, and say that's going to be enough to satisfy us when we're trying to define what a denomination is and how it works in American society?
Theology is one small part of it, and I would never urge that it be overlooked, but it often tends to be highly traditional, derivative, articulated in the 1830s, and then we're trying to find out how it is digested in the 1930s.
Right.
Personally, I think people have a lot of motives for behavior and a lot of other pressures fashioning their behavior beyond just ideas or certainly theological ideas. So it's old, it's outdated, it's usually male-dominated.
Mm-hmm.
And I think
it's closer to philosophy than religion.
Not abstract as much as marginal in being a driving force in people's lives.
Well, again, let me turn to Jan.
It's essential, but it's not the whole story.
Let me turn to Jan Shipps. You study the Mormons. Is there a single burning issue, burning question that, as a historian, you bring to this enterprise of looking at this group of people?
Well, as a non-Mormon, I bring to the study of Mormonism, as a non-Mormon studying Mormonism,
mm-hmm.
I bring to this topic the question of how religion works. How does religion work in culture? Right now, I'm very much concerned with how belief shapes personal identity and how the experience of being in a community of like-minded religious people mm-hmm. tells you who you are. But the sociologists who are studying the way religion is worked out in our culture are telling us that there is a reconfiguration.
Mm.
That there, at one time, we had what is sometimes called mainstream, sometimes called mainline American Protestantism.
Mm-hmm.
And everything else was defined in relationship to that. Were you a Methodist, a Baptist, a Presbyterian, an Episcopalian? One of the main Lutheran, you know, so
all
forth.
Right. And
or
what's
were you?
What's happened in contrast to that?
Well, the we now know from the results of some major studies of mainline American religion
mm-hmm.
that people do not as often join or do not stay in those churches the way they once did. We used to have a pattern of denominational identity. If you were born a Methodist and you moved from one place to the next, then the likelihood is that you would leave one Methodist church and go to another.
Uh-huh.
Now, the likelihood is that people look for like-minded people, and they might be Methodist one place and Presbyterians the next place, and the next place with a highly mobile society, they'd be Lutheran.
Or United Fund and Save the Rainforest.
As a form of religion.
That's right.
Indeed. They want to do, it gives them a sense of fulfillment in doing good for people. It gives an orientation in their lives. And so the different forms of expression are myriad. But I think one of the things I am interested in is watching these transformations and seeing how the same sort of thing takes so many different outward expressions.
Do you have to be a believer or a non-believer to look at denominational history, Henry?
I don't think so.
What about that?
There are times when I think it would be better if non-members were assigned the task of looking at an institution, because they wouldn't have some kind of inside motivation to speak better for it. They wouldn't fudge the facts.
It's a kind of a damned if you do and damned if you don't. I mean,
right.
If you're a believer, Henry, then I may or may not be inclined to take your word
right.
about brand X, and the same thing goes for you, Jan.
Well, in fact, you use the brand X. There has been, in this conference, a good deal of talk about how denominational leaders
uh-huh.
are concerned about brand loyalty. Going, the people move from place to place if they don't.
Well, I mean,
the
know,
brand.
What
buddy.
American society is driven by marketing concepts.
True.
Why should I be surprised at this sort of thing? What about the?
Well,
what
I
about
guess to
the,
follow that metaphor, I'm just concerned that they stay consumers.
Well, let me ask you about the state of belief in this country in the 1990s. Regardless of whether you're going to look at it from the standpoint of big shot sort of church politicians or the lowly, the neglected, the marginalized, belief in a healthy state, Henry?
I think it is, in the sense that belief is part of spiritual meditation, religion in general. It's something that motivates people and orients their lives, and so I would say the same thing about belief as I would religion. It's just there, and we need to ferret out what it means to different layers of people and how they interact.
Jan?
There is a great concern, and there's a popular notion of America becoming a secular society, a secularized culture. And yet, when we say that it's not the way it used to be, it's true it's not the way it used to be, but the reconfiguration of religion is taking place every day and giving us a different religion in a different form.
And the benefit of that is we're finally realizing it, and we say it's probably been this way for over a century.
Mm-hmm. Well, our politics have always been secular, and now you're telling me that our religion is secular?
No, I'm not saying the religion is secular. I'm saying that there is a general perception that our culture has become a secular culture. And we're suggesting that may be a misperception, or at least the perception may be overstated.
And as long as Episcopalian President George Bush cries before the Southern Baptist Convention, don't tell me politics is secular either.
That's right.
Jan Shipps and Henry Bowden, I appreciate your participation on Soundings. I wish you well in your work. You've been here at the Humanities Center for a conference on the writing of denominational history. Thanks for your time here on the radio.
Thank you.
Thank you.
This is Soundings, a program of ideas and insights from the National Humanities Center. I'm Wayne Pond. You've just heard discussions about the Dead Sea Scrolls, the ethics of scholarship, and the writing of denominational religious history. If you'd like a cassette copy of this program, send $5 to the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina. The zip code is 27709. Please ask for program number 591. That's program number 591, the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, the zip code 27709. Send $2 for a complete listing of Soundings discussions available on cassettes. The National Humanities Center welcomes your comments and suggestions. Next week, the first in a series of programs for Black History Month 1992. Over the next 4 weeks, you'll hear about Duke Ellington, race and rhetoric, multiculturalism and American education, and black philosophy. A program note before closing this week. At the outset, you may have noticed a new version of the Soundings theme. The music is Post-Horn Duetto, a 19th century composition by A.F. Knight, used on Soundings courtesy of the Smithsonian Institution. The new version was arranged and produced by Jeffrey Perry of Duke University. Our thanks to Jeff Perry, and thanks to you for listening to Soundings. Please join me again next week at this time on this radio station. Until then, this is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center.
Partial support for this program comes from the A.J. Fletcher Foundation and from Carolina Power and Light, where listening generates powerful ideas. Major funding for Soundings comes from the National Endowment for the Humanities.
The Dead Sea Scrolls and Modern Religious History, this week on Soundings. I'm Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Eric Myers of Duke University discusses the contemporary importance of the Dead Sea Scrolls and the ethics of modern scholarship. Jan Shipps of Indiana University and Henry Bowden of Rutgers University explain the writing of modern denominational history. The Dead Sea Scrolls and Accounts of Contemporary Religion. Some answers and insights from the National Humanities Center this week on Soundings.